The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1978. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it a fun tribute to a classic Beatles album, or should we just grab the bug spray? We watch Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1978 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? Got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast, this time looking at Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band from 1978. That's a mouthful. I am Trevor Holland and I am joined by my good friend and co-host and suggester of this movie,
Christian Fletcher. It may be as hard to say as Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, but we'll call it Sgt. Pepper's from now on. Thank you, Trevor, for welcoming me back and letting me suggest this oddity that we both hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think as I said last time, as you were saying it, I was thinking, I know this movie, I know it exists, I've briefly seen the intro, but I have no idea what I'm in for, which I think always adds an extra layer to these movies when you just got no idea what to expect. you're just going off reputation.
And I think if those listeners who were listening last time, we actually, this week, and for whenever you're listening, June 2017 marks 50 years since the release of the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band original album by the Beatles. So I thought, Trevor, you know, whilst we're looking at all things Beatles at the moment with the anniversary, I thought, why not, for the redeeming features, look at, you know, one of their, well, actually, not one of their films, but one of the interesting films that fits into this category.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I totally agree that if there's any time to watch it, I guess the 50th anniversary of the original album, if you can't watch it, then when can you watch it?
And depending,
if you watch it at all, it's
depending
up to you.
On what, how we review it, people may not want to ever watch it again or want to watch it every day, so we'll wait and see.
Absolutely. So we better start off and... And yeah, basically, we'll start with the synopsis, because this is a movie version, I guess, of the Sgt. Pepper's album. So this is what I've dug up. A veritable who's who of the rock and roll scene of the late 1970s join forces for this romp, loosely inspired by the Beatles album of the same name, where a rock band comes to the rescue of a small town suffering from boredom.
I even think saying the term 70s rock and roll or rock stars even is a bit of a bit of a stretch looking at the unusual cast list that we're presented with. And it seems to be, but I have read reviews that say that it is very much a 70s pop culture on film. And I think it definitely is. Yeah, if you talk about the last scene, there's a who's who. But what an interesting cast list.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some big names in there as well as some people that... I think a largely forgotten, 40 years down the track just about. So, but yeah, I'm sure we can touch on quite a bit of that. But before we do, and actually, in fact, this may even bring some of it up, I think, as always, we do need to start with our turkey trivia. So we talk a bit of turkey about the maybe not turkey and of course some trivia as well. So, I've dug up a few stats. This one is rated 3.9 out of 10 on IMDb. It had a budget of $18 million and a box office of $12.9 million. So not the greatest performance even back in the late 70s.
I actually find it interesting that considering we've spoken about films, I don't know, inflation exists, but spoken about a few films recently that have had budgets heaps bigger than that. I thought that was quite interesting that it's only that amount, considering the names that we use. But as you said, Trevor, some of those were names that we probably weren't going to hear about again. But they definitely were putting everything into this. Now, I think Robert Stigwood had just come off Grease and Saturday Night Fever as being these big hits, and he was always very big on the... You obviously notice in the credits, RSO, the Robert Stigwood Organisation. I know they actually parody that emblem a few times in the movie, but he was definitely riding on the success still of Grease, so I can really see how he's gone. Okay, we had a hit with Grease, and Barry Gibb was singing the title song. Oh, Saturday Night Fever was a big hit. I can really see, yeah, if you think about the time, you can see why this probably seemed like an obvious thing to do next, I suppose.
Yeah, well, like I said, out of the news, the new bit as well, where we look at any awards or nominations, and this one was nominated for an award. It was nominated for the Worst Supporting Actress at the Stinkers Bad Movie Awards of 1978 for Diane Steinberg, who I believe played Lucy in the movie.
Oh, God, it hardly seemed like she was barely in it, I suppose. But interesting, I thought you were going to say it was the Strawberry Fields actress, but we'll get to that a bit later. But interesting that they were doing Stinker Awards back then. But I don't know if you came across this too, Trevor, but apparently it's regarded, the soundtrack album is regarded as one of the worst albums ever recorded. It went, I don't know if this term's correct, it went flat platinum or back platinum, which is, instead of going platinum, that's the amount of records they had to send back. Apparently for years later, they were still destroying copies of the vinyl record because no one purchased it. Yet it still spawned a couple of hit singles, I believe, and was actually in the charts for a while. But I think I read a review saying, you know, that they signify people that were deaf in the audience. But yeah, so interesting that it's got those, I suppose accolades aren't the word, but yeah, and it was happening at that sort of time when disco backlash was about to happen, you know, all those sort of artists were, and as much as we're not looking at, I suppose, a disco movie, it still can quite easily be lumped into that category.
Yeah, I mean, you have a situation where as you mentioned, like, you know, the Gibbs, the Bee Gees, and Brian Frampton play the title band, I guess, Sergeant Peppers, with Peter Frampton there as Billy Shears. If you know your Sergeant Peppers, you know that name features in that album. But yeah, with regards to trivia, and probably like quite a number of the big names in there, I did find out that Aerosmith, who make an appearance as the future villain band towards the end, were actually the second choice. Kiss was approached first, but they turned down the role, fearing it would hurt their image, and instead opted to star in Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, which was also released in 1978.
I've actually screened that movie. Actually, you've given me an idea, Trevor. We need to look at that movie in the future. But yeah, quite interesting. I don't know.
Oh, no!
But that said, you know, not to skip a little bit ahead, Aerosmith doing Come Together is probably one of the highlights of the film, and I believe was a hit sing, like I said, there was a couple of singles released from the movie, and this was one that actually, you know, charted quite well. So yeah, I think they made a wise choice getting Aerosmith instead. I didn't know how Steven Tyler would feel about being killed at the end. Spoiler alert, but anyway.
Did I write down that bit of trivia about that? I didn't actually do that directly, but apparently, yeah, the script had Peter Frampton actually defeating Steve Tyler and killing him. And Aerosmith had none of that and said, look, if they're going to die, it's going to be by accident, because there's no way that Steve Tyler was going to get killed by Peter Frampton. It just wasn't going to happen.
Now, I don't know much about Peter Frampton, but I get the feeling that he was quite a daggy star of the time. Like, he had that big record, Frampton Comes Alive, in the early 70s. But is it true he was considered quite daggy? Is that really, you know, you've got to give me some context.
Well, to tell you the truth, I never was much of a Peter Frampton anything, really. It kind of registers me as someone who had a big album in the past that being called Frampton Comes Alive is often made fun of, and believe me, I was watching this with Susie. She was watching a bit of this with me, and we kept making jokes about how Frampton was coming alive in various circumstances.
So, oh, so many times that would apply.
Probably won't go any deeper into some of those gags. They want to keep this PG. Now, another face that I saw in this, and I got to admit, though, when I saw him in the movie, I'll get him a bit later, I wasn't 100% sure, but Alice Cooper, during the making of this movie, was actually checked into a New York rehab facility. He was granted a temporary leave for 3 days to record his vocals and shoot his scenes for the film.
Oh, my God. But now that you've told me that, Trevor, I literally feel what he was going through was pretty much shown on screen, because he was so out of it, and he was almost playing this psychedelic arcade game and seeing this vision of himself. Oh, yeah, it was pretty weird. So that kind of makes a bit more sense.
Yeah, that was a very, very odd scene, which I'm sure, yes, we will definitely be touching on later. Now, originally, because another thing about this movie that we'll touch on, but originally the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton were given dialogue, but they all had British accents, and the film was supposed to be taking place in Middle America. So that's when they made the decision that they would do away with all the dialogue and use George Burns' role as narrator to supply the dialogue for all the characters. I'm guessing they couldn't do a convincing American accent.
But so essentially we were seeing a 70s rock opera like Jesus Christ Superstar or Tommy. That's kind of that era where, yeah, there was an entire movie with no dialogue. But it's interesting, as you said, that it was because they couldn't actually deliver it very well. But I've heard that a few years earlier, you know, George Martin, who produced a lot of the Beatles' work, you know, there was talk of, you know, producing a musical based on the songs. I think Robert Stigwood had bought the permission to all of the songs that are included in the movie. And I think it was opened as Sgt. Pepper's on the Road, it was called, in the early 70s as a stage show, which I kind of think it should have stayed. But anyway, and then that's sort of what they used when they made the movie adaptation. So that's giving us a bit of background in why all these songs have just been thrown together in this film. He's pretty much gone, okay, Saturday Night Fever was huge, Grease was huge, I've got these Beatles songs, what are we going to do next? So hence where we're coming from. And so I suppose any kind of plot or characterization is sort of done away with as much as possible just to, you know, get these songs on film.
Mm-hmm. And again, I may have a few comments about that coming up. Speaking of the Beatles, apparently Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr both attended the premiere, but subsequently shunned the film, whilst John Lennon and George Harrison refused to view the film at all. So the Beatles weren't big fans of Sgt. Pepper's.
I think I read somewhere that George Harrison actually said, oh, I feel sorry for the Bee Gees. They were at the height of their career and then they did this. And I think the bad thing that happened was just before it came out, the Bee Gees said in the press, you know, forget about the Beatles. Once this album comes out, you will not be able to think of anything except us as Sgt. Pepper's. I bet they wish they'd never said that.
Well, considering another bit of trivia I found out was that 2 weeks into the production of the movie, the Bee Gees tried to get dropped from the film.
Oh, they were already seeing what a bad thing it was going to be for their career.
Yeah, and you got things like Frankie Howard saying later, the film was like Saturday Night Fever, but without the fever.
Oh, and I think it's Sgt. Pepper's without the Beatles, so that can always be a bit dubious. So, but yeah, so quite interesting. So they were coming at it with, they were very ambitious, let's just say that.
Yeah, well, Robert Stigwood, this is my final bit, obviously, is that Robert Stigwood actually envisioned the film as being that generation's Gone with the Wind. He had very high hopes.
Oh, gosh. Considering I lump it in with something like Can't Stop the Music or Xanadu. But anyway, we digress. But what I actually did like was, you know, well, being a big Beatles fan, I did love the fact that it had mainly songs from, obviously, Sgt. Pepper's, but also songs from Abbey Road. And I will mention later in this, it was hard for me to watch this without making references to the 2007, I suppose, movie musical, Across the Universe, which possibly adapted a little bit better than these guys did. So it was very hard for me to watch it with, you know, trying to forget the other film. But you have to remember this was 1978.
Okay, now, after all that, quite a bit of information there, this is the redeeming features cast. So what we do is we like to see what we're working from. So what we do is we grab a review, a baseline review to see what the less popular opinions are out there. So what I've got here is a review titled Not Even a So Bad It's Good Kind of Movie. I saw this in the theatre when I was 8 years old. Barely remembered it, except I did remember that I was bored out of my mind. Thought I'd have a better appreciation for the film now that I'm older. Boy, was I wrong. Had to watch it 3 times to get through it because I fell asleep twice. What was everyone who starred in this movie thinking of? Anyone reading the script had to have had known it sounded stupid. Premise: town band makes all problems go away, ends wars, and makes everyone happy as soon as they start playing music. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Besides, who cares? Boring enough for an adult, even more so for an 8-year-old kid. Seeing this again refreshed my memory why I was so bored seeing it when I was a kid. All my brothers and sisters went to see this with me, thinking, since it casted the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton, that we were going to get down. We sort of expected another Saturday Night Fever, not this boring crap of how this band makes everyone happy. Effectively ended a few careers, including Peter Frampton and Sandy Farina, who disappeared off the face of the earth after this movie. How did she get casted anyway? Her singing is amateuristic, and the instrumentals to her singing sounded like something you'd hear in a grocery store or doctor's office. There was attempt at camp, i.e. names like Strawberry Fields, Mean Mr. Mustard, Billy Shears, Heartland, etc., that wasn't funny and fell completely flat. 1 star.
Well, I think it's single-handedly managed to sum up quite a lot of facets of this movie that, you know, did come to mind, but it was probably a bit harsh in some respects. But yeah, no, that's definitely a great 1-star review to work from.
Yeah, well, there was another 1-star review that was just one word, which was sucks. I thought we could use a bit more detail than that one.
The lazy reviewer, we don't want to hear from them.
But yeah, but like that last line there where they talked about, you know, the attempts at camp, like when the movie opens, it opens in the village of Flou de Coupe. Yeah,
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it's so many of these movies, like these rock operas, that don't have any script as such. You know, you've got to rely on these kind of visual aids aside from the songs themselves, and they seem to throw a lot in. And that's what I sort of realised with this. It became a sort of, let's spot the Beatles reference, even if some of them were just excruciatingly obvious.
But yeah, between that narration and then achieving world peace in World War One via big band, it certainly didn't take too long to really, I suppose, let you know what the movie was about.
Oh, definitely. And we're sort of seeing for the first time these little title cards, which you see them use, again, when they don't have any dialogue to say. They use these title cards at kind of random places throughout the movie to try and give us a bit of narration aside from George Burns. Now, who played is Mr. Kite, that's right. Quite a different Mr. Kite than Across the Universe, but we'll leave that one alone. But quite interestingly...
Yeah, mayor of Heartland, Mr. Kite.
Yes, yeah. But what I thought was quite funny is, the whole time I just thought his voice sounded like Peter Falk in Princess Bride. I just kept waiting for him to say, as you wish, and all these different things, but I don't know, that's the first thing that came to mind. I could see myself getting into it, but then I'm like, oh no, this isn't Princess Bride, I can't enjoy it. We'll wait and see. But
that you did mention that, yeah, that really was that same sort of vibe and that same sort of voice. It didn't even click until just now.
Let's just say, I think if you don't, it's quite inconceivable to compare the two. But anyway, I know that you're pretty much just waiting. You know, I know they're trying to set up this, you know, give us a bit of a background, but you really are just waiting for this Sgt. Pepper's album to play, because you're going into this expecting it to be, as you said earlier, pretty much the album played from start to finish, I suppose, with a plot. Not, you know, maybe not expecting all these other songs to come in a little bit later. So, of course, as you said, in the middle of the war, you've got this band coming out of it, and I think what did they work out that, I was going to say, that Sergeant Pepper, I think he died when he came back to do his last concert, and Heartland was unhappy ever since, so they had to bring back a band. But God, were they expecting to bring back Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees? Surely some people would have been annoyed.
Yeah, well, everyone seemed happy, but I mean, I did like in that opening, I did kind of like how they showed the different eras and the different things of just the band playing, and it's all just this brass band playing away, and you had like just signifying all the things that had happened between World War One and when Sergeant Pepper just dropped dead when they were dedicating the town weather vane to him, I believe it was.
But it always points
which
to
is, I was like, oh, that's a big tribute. Yep. But yeah, I kind of did like that because I'm a sucker for a big band. I really am. You know, like that nice fat horn section just really is something that grabs me. So the fact that they just had all these little snippets of them playing in different situations, I've got to admit, I started enjoying myself at that point, you know, with the actual music side of things.
Yeah, and I remember actually thinking when I was watching that bit going, oh, they've actually put a bit more thought into this rather than it just being, you know, let's just open with Sgt. Pepper's as the opening song. Like, they've put a bit of a background in, because I believe that was playing behind it the whole time, the actual song, Sgt. Pepper's, but in the different, yeah, the different variations with the brass section, so... But I think it was pretty much here where, as I mentioned, when they brought in Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees as being the new Sgt. Pepper's band, and I think this was the first time I noticed that we're seeing the character Strawberry Fields. We find out her name's that a little bit later, but we see a sign and saying, I was mentioning Beatles references before, and I saw, you know, you got the property of Mr. and Mrs. Fields, and I sat there thinking to myself, oh, there's going to be a Strawberry Fields reference a bit later. So it kind of became one of those things where you wanted to spot the references, but unfortunately, as I said earlier, a lot of the references were very obvious rather than more subliminal. I don't know, I would have liked to have seen a few Beatles LPs in the background in windows or something like that, but no, they didn't seem to go that angle at all.
No, just really mainly naming characters after song lyrics. Oh, yeah, we got Peter Frampton as Billy Shears. Not too sure why he needed to have his name on his overalls. That seemed like an odd choice.
Considering they actually reference Billy Shears and here's Billy Shears. Like, how many times do they say his name? You don't need it written on there.
Yep. But I mean, I suppose, you know, when it started and that they do start with actually doing the song Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, and you know what, I've following on from that, I was finding myself enjoying the music at this point in time. It just kind of had a sense of fun behind it, and it was just song after song after song. They go from Sgt. Pepper's to with a little help from my friends, and it's all, you know, all quite uppity and quite fun throughout this entirely opening segment. But the way the song comes song after song after song, I was just wondering how they were going to sustain it for the full length of the movie.
You're considering, as we were saying, you know, at this point, they're pretty much going track by track of the Sgt. Pepper's album. So, yeah, you're thinking, I think it's about probably, I think the first song is Here Comes the Sun, or one of those songs. It's the first that's not of that album, and that's probably about 20 minutes into the movie. So yeah, you're waiting for it to start getting to to keep going to the next track. But and that's the problem with a lot of these sort of movies, is trying to get sort of trying to get a plot out of it is quite hard, and it's also very thin. And I felt even early on that the whole use of a lot of the songs was really badly kind of connected. Like, you've got we're familiar with things nowadays like Mamma Mia and things where, you know, they've written a story based on a back catalogue, but there's a lot of things, especially when a lot of those Sgt. Pepper's album songs are open to interpretation. Like, I think the first one that comes to mind is when, that's right, so after they've done their opening concert with Billy Shears and Sgt. Pepper's, and then with a little help from my friends, we go into Fixing a Hole, let's just say that. I think that's the next song with George Burns in the first of the excruciating covers in this movie, let's just say. But,
Mr. Kite getting in on the action. Yeah, but it's funny, interesting choice.
But I've seen a few docos where, you know, Fixing a Hole is open to interpretation. It's a lot of people have said it's about drug use and things like that. So see what I mean? Like, a lot of these songs were taken into a context that was probably a bit too literal, where I don't know. And again, mentioning Across the Universe, it kind of flowed a bit more as it was, and it was edited a lot differently too, where it kind of went from scene to scene. Whereas this, they were trying to literally sing a narrative and using the song, you know, the song lyrics that weren't even changed one bit. And I felt this Fixing a Hole was the first time it started to probably come unhinged in terms of, as you said, with that big opening, it kind of started to go, oh, this is not good.
Yeah, because, I mean, George, you know, he just wanted to become the popular town singing person now that the Sergeant Pepper's new band has gotten an offer for a record company thing, which is the first time we also come across that that narration where he actually substitutes a dialogue where, yeah, as he says their lines, you can see their mouths moving just so, like, alongside with it, which, again, you know, that was quite well done and quite well lip-synced, as opposed to some of the cases with Peter Frampton and not so well lip-syncing with the actual songs he's meant to be singing. Yeah, that's another matter entirely.
But I think it was around this. But like we've watched, I'm sure even with us, I know JC and the Pussycats and a few other Gem and the Holograms. We've watched so many movies, Trevor, where it's the whole small town band gets discovered and taken to Hollywood, where bad things happen. So essentially, we're thrown into that plot quite early on, and I know it's around this time we see Mean Mr. Mustard, which again is based off a Beatles song, as the villain who's introduced into this. Because it was funny, at first I'm sort of thinking that Donald Pleasance is going to become the villain as the record tycoon, but he was more sort of, hey, the guy that kind of got them discovered, not really. I thought it was going to become a different sort of thing, but oh my God, I'm looking into the plot of this movie. It doesn't even exist.
Yeah, because Mean Mr. Mustard, who's part of the Mustard Real Estate, who we find out through heavily synthesized lyrics from his robot sex
don't
toys.
Get me started on the robots.
I could barely understand the lyrics at the best of times. It was so heavily, heavily synthesized with that. But then, yeah, you also with Donald Pleasance, like, there's one point where they're almost sending him, like, you know, to be, the great tempter, the temptation, I suppose, when you look at the, when you've got, like, a devil-like character, but then he ends up, you know, basically drugs them in order to get them to sign up, but then basically just make sure they get lots of gigs and TV appearances, so it's not all that bad at the end. And that whole scene, I suppose, where they actually, first of all, they go to Hollywood by balloon, which is an interesting choice. But then with the whole sequence of, you know, I want you, so, and they're singing it like the scantily clad female limo driver is singing it to Peter Frampton, and I'm just thinking to her, will you keep your eyes on the road? And then the brother was singing it to her, and Donald Pleasance was singing it to all of them, and it's just like, it just kept on going on and on and on. That was such a long scene. And then it's looking, oh, that's how they're going to make this movie last longer. They're going to pad out some of this stuff to the point of ridiculousness.
And that's like what I was saying yesterday, where a lot of these songs didn't necessarily work in well with the plot as such, because I'm just thinking to myself, why does everyone want them? Like, everyone's obsessed, everyone wants them, and then I'm thinking, how many of these women are going to be really annoyed about them saying, oh, she's so heavy? And there's one part in the song where Peter Frampton, the Bee Gees, go, Heather, and hold the note and just look at the camera, and I was, like, creeped out. I kind of wanted to look away. Like, stop doing that.
Stop looking at me!
I almost felt like I was being drugged before they were, but it was funny because I think around this point we mentioned about the hot air balloon, and then the next thing there, magically, yeah, I think it's before that, but yeah, around that, they magically appear in the plane. That was just weird, but I wasn't going to question too many things. But I did think it was interesting. I don't know if the Bee Gees were trying to, loosen up their image a bit, but it's funny in that scene that we mentioned where they're drugging them, but you've got Barry Gibb, like, having a joint and everything like that, and I'm like, oh, I wonder if that was them thinking they were being really rebellious for their image.
Yeah, they're branching out and getting... getting risque and, hey, look, we're cool and hip like the cool hip kids.
It's the only way they could get through the movie, I think.
Yeah, I that does come back a bit later on when, towards the end of the movie where they're doing, I have gone blank. I should not go blank on this. Got up, fell out of bed, dragged a cool.
Day in the Life.
Day in the Life. How could I figure that? bad yeah. Beatles fan, bad. But even that, you know, when they said, you know, when I had a smoke and it cuts back to them flashing back to the record booth and there's Donald Pleasance sharing a joint with him. It was just like, okay, that's... there's no subtlety there.
Yeah, well, but that's what I said. Like, that's where they've taken so much of the lyrics so literally. Like, you know, and that even though I know we are jumping ahead, but Day in the Life, there was a couple of bits where he's singing, you know, bit before he's earlier, he said, "Oh, all I could do was laugh" or something like that, and I'm like, God, this does not fit a scene after a funeral. But anyway, but yeah, no, as we found out, they kind of throw the references in.
We'll get back to that.
Left, right, and center. But and that's sort of what I was noticing around this point. We're probably at the sort of half an hour mark, but and like earlier we'd spoken about those opening two songs, and you know they were passable. They worked well as okay covers. They weren't, you know, ludicrous, you know. But that's the problem. That's the thing I started to realize. I think it was when they started doing. They did Good Morning, which was like a montage to show their rise to stardom, but then it went straight into them doing Nowhere Man, and I think that was the first time I started to realize. I might have been stupid being this the first time, but I started to realize that the Bee Gees just didn't have the strength in their vocals to really carry these Beatles songs. It just sort of started to fall flat around there for me.
Yeah, I mean, a moderately decent cover band, I suppose, is what you could look at. They can perform it. It doesn't sound terrible, but there's nothing special about it. I guess that's the level of the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton were at. But I think that was actually quite funny where they were singing one particular song, and actually I think it was Oh Darling, and like everyone left one by one, and basically, you know, okay, so the song could continue without Peter Frampton being there, or without that, okay, it can just continue by just one Gibb brother at a keyboard, just keeps on going.
Well, that's interesting. That version of Oh Darling was actually one of the hit singles from the film. When I say hit, it reached the top 30 or something. It was in the charts for a while. And that was actually one of those scenes where I really could have just sat back and it could have been, because it was sort of them recording in the studio, it could have just been this simple scene. But like with a lot of things in this film, there always had to be something in the background, like someone having a fight with someone to try and advance the plot. And it always, I don't know, it always kind of took you out a bit and didn't really, I don't know, you started to get to the point where you didn't care. But I know we were talking about, you know, the whole of Rise to Stardom, but I really did like that band montage that they did with Polythene Pam, and she came in through the bathroom window, you know, at the concert. Although I thought things like that were kind of cool, you know, and doing the montages. And I suppose giving these lesser-known Beatles songs a bit of a play was, I thought, pretty, you know, kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you could see that there were ideas there. It's just... They sort of came in short bursts rather than being something consistent across the movie. Like when we got the Mean Mr. Mustard song, and it was just largely Mr. Mustard just mugging to the camera and looking through his TV monitors at all the stuff where there could not possibly be cameras watching people. And it's like, where are these cameras? I think he even follows Strawberry up to her bedroom at one point, and her bedroom walls covered with pictures of Peter Frampton. I'm thinking, this woman is she his girlfriend or his stalker? I can't quite tell by the level of life size photos on the wall and pictures everywhere. It's kind of creepy there, Strawberry. I'm sorry, but
she's a bit creepy when you think about it. Like I love how they've tried. I'll talk about the robots as a second bit, but in the song She's Leaving Home, obviously they're making reference to Strawberry leaving home, but I just love how, again, to fit the lyrics, you know, she's lived out most of her life, like I thought she lived with her parents, she lived alone, I don't know, but then I love how at the end the parents literally just go bye, yeah, see ya, she's off to chase Peter Frampton. But we mentioned, you mentioned before about passable cover bands with Bee Gees. Let's just say, Trevor, they were passable, if not amazing, in comparisons to the robots doing a song. That would have to have been one of the creepiest versions of She's Leaving Home I've ever heard. Kate Bush covered it, and it was amazing. So those robots just really creeped me out. And this is when it started to get to the stage where I'm like, oh, gosh, now I can see why this is the worst soundtrack of all time.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff with, the songs with because it was, I think it was Frankie Howard playing Mr. Mustard. You know, he may have been a well-known comedian, but as a music performer, I mean, he basically says most of his lines anyway. But the fact that he's backed up by these robots is just like, yeah, none of this works. None of this works. Why is this song still going? Can we just, we got the point, just cut this one short and move back on to the stuff that's much better in comparison.
And well, that's the thing, that there was a little couple of points later on where I've written in my notes here. I actually kind of enjoyed when they'd have instrumentals of some of the songs to, you know, like, why didn't they have her just getting in a bus or doing a short 1 minute montage with the, I don't know, the instrumental of She's Leaving Home in the background. They instead have to play out every verse and be so literal with every lyric that you just start to go, oh gosh, like, you're being a bit too obvious, guys. Like, I think it could have been a bit more subtle.
I mean, definitely not subtle, but kind of after all that, it definitely picked up again when Strawberry got to Hollywood and there's the billboards
of Sgt. Pepper's
and Lucy and the Diamonds side by side, and it just turns into this whole thing with Lucy and the Diamonds doing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds on the billboards, and then Sgt. Pepper's turns up and being tempted over. It's like, that, you know, that's actually one of my favourite Beatles songs of all time, so I would have liked to have seen it be done a bit better, but In context of what it just came out of, it was definitely a relief for this temptation of Sgt. Pepper's within Strawberry's hallucination of what was happening on those billboards. Again, it's just Strawberry's strange. Okay, straight up, Strawberry is an odd character.
No, have you heard her name? Like, but that's the thing. I know what you mean about the rooftop part, and I actually saw it as the famous final performance by the Beatles was done on a rooftop, and I actually saw this as a subtle reference to that. They probably weren't being that clever, but I did actually really appreciate this scene. But yeah, I was kind of waiting for so much more from the way she delivered this song. Like, I think they could have done a lot more with the Lucy and the Diamonds characters. Possibly had them more as, I don't know, the Little Shop of Horrors girls. We will talk about Little Shop of Horrors in the next scene, actually. But yeah, I felt that it was very much, it could have gone a lot further than it did, but as you said, it probably stood out a lot in what we'd seen recently in that movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's straight from there that we... do we go straight from there to Steve Martin? I think it might be. I'm trying to remember how we segued to Dr. Maxwell.
Because I think it was Oh Darling and Strawberry came along and got them all out of the studio, and they managed to hijack Mr. Mustard's bus and then started tracking down where the magical instruments had gone.
Oh, that's right. They all got stolen from the statues in the museum. And I'm like, guys, shouldn't you have more than just a little rope across the front of the museum display? But anyway, wasn't that just asking for trouble?
absolutely. But yeah, the first place they go is to Dr. Maxwell's. with Dr. Maxwell played by Steve Martin, and oh my god, I enjoyed this scene way too much.
Because I know that we're both big Little Shop of Horrors fans, and I personally think Steve Martin's best movie is Little Shop of Horrors. So it's so enjoyable seeing him playing anything kind of medical and twisted, which is, you know, both those characters in a nutshell. But I think, Trevor, we'd mentioned, you know, knowing about this movie. Even before I'd seen this movie or knew much about it, I'd always heard of the infamous Steve Martin scene. And I finally got to see it, and it's as insane as it lives up as it lives up to.
Yeah, Mr. Maxwell's silver hammer making old people young again via a very campy tune, and if you know any Steve Martin stuff, particularly his Little Shop of Horrors performance, you can pretty much picture what he does in this scene. And like I said, it was just like, I had a very good time watching that scene when they try to retrieve the instrument from his thing, and they end up having a fight, and there's these weird effects that they've basically just been drawn directly under the actual print of the film, I think.
Well, remember, they've only got an $18 million budget.
That's very, very true.
They had to pay for, not Peter Frampton, or maybe the Bee Gees. Anyway, one of them that was really expensive. And I was going to say, Alice Cooper, who's coming in the next scene, he probably would have been quite cheap. He probably didn't even realise he was there.
Yeah. 3 days leave from rehab. I think he was just happy to do whatever he could to get out for a little bit. But yeah, look. After Maxwell Silver Hammer, we get a bit of drama in the movie with Billy Shears unconscious and unresponsive until Strawberry comes along and sings Strawberry Fields Forever to him and brings him back to life by crying on his face. Oh, and there was a lot of water going on his face. It must have been pouring out of her eyes.
It was very reminiscent of Alice in Wonderland. I half expected her to start drinking or him to start drinking. But that was, again, one of those things where you're like, okay, I'm glad you used this Strawberry Fields song. It was obvious considering you've used her name. But again, let me take you to Strawberry Fields. It's just like me singing, let me take you to Christian Fletcher. Like, it just did not work, literally. They could have done something a bit different with this. But yeah, that was one of those things where, I don't know, it just didn't seem to fit. But to be honest, I did welcome hearing this song. I'm a big fan of this song, often regarded as the first psychedelic song ever written. But we heard that reviewer that sort of mentioned that her singing wasn't too good. I actually found the Strawberry Field, like, I know she was annoying, but her singing in this song was fine. I found the version quite, I don't know, enjoyable, let's just say, but even if it was weird.
Yeah, it was fine, and I think you mentioned earlier Here Comes the Sun, which was also her song as she woke up in a haystack with Peter Frampton. It's a decent enough, you know. It's a decent enough performance. You probably really can't say it's anything. It's not bad. It's not setting new heights, but you know, it's certainly perfectly decent and just unfortunate that I suppose the scene in which she's singing Strawberry Fields is just so ridiculous, and there's like these little thought bubbles are circling around Peter Frampton's face as he comes back into consciousness of him with Strawberry. It's just like, oh, God. And it's in the back of that bloody mustard van with those robots.
Oh, no, they're obsessed. Well. God, that seemed like the set they were most interested in using. It must have been the cheapest to do, because apparently the whole movie was filmed on the back lot at Universal, but that little bit, they only had to use a small area.
Very much so.
And I suppose, yeah, there's not too many sort of female characters, so I suppose she sort of held her own, but I spent half the movie thinking it was Helen Reddy, to be honest, so I'm glad we summed up that it wasn't her, but I don't know why I was thinking that. But anyway, we go off now. I think, again, we've spoken about these things flashing on the screen, and they're obsessed with flashing the whole love and money, like, what is it, we don't like love, we like money, or I don't know, it keeps flashing up on the screen, and they pretty much took me a while to read half of the things that flashed up because of the font they were using, but they pretty much said they've got to go to, was it father son to steal a tuba, was it? I don't know if it was there, but
yeah, got to get the tuba back from father son, played by Alice Cooper, who with that mustache, I thought, I know Alice Cooper's in this movie, but for some reason I found myself thinking, is that Alice Cooper or Frank Zappa?
Oh my God, I think in the song when they've got his face in that round, there's one of the movies he did, it might have been 200 Motels. There's one movie he's done where he's done something similar with his face in a circle like that. I thought exactly the same thing. And yeah, but remember we did, was it about 2 or 3 years ago, we did Sextet from 1978, that Mae West musical. And this is the same year. So I get the feeling Alice Cooper was being signed up to things that he had no clue about. Because I see him turn up in so many of these movies that you wouldn't expect this shock rock artist to be in, let's just say.
Yeah, probably, I guess part of his rehab, I'm guessing, is to do stuff not as Alice Cooper.
Instead of picking up litter on the side of the road. Oh, hang on, he's not a criminal, but anyway.
We'll get him to assist the elderly being being Mae West in this awful, 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 awful movie.
Because I think it's around this because he does that the very creepy version of Because, which is a very kind of eerie song anyway. But when you've got sort of Alice Cooper looking at you with devil eyes in a circle of psychedelic images, going because the world is round. Oh, I kind of couldn't wait to finish. Sorry, Alice.
Yeah, and the room full of people who had. Because, as when Dr. Maxwell made the old people young again, they kind of ended up in these skimpy, almost scout uniforms. And then we go to Alice Cooper as Father Son. And in this room, watching these screens, are all these people in the skimpy scout uniforms, just all acting in unison in response to what he's doing. And it's like, that is kind of creepy. You can't avoid that.
Well, especially the whole time I'm thinking, what are we seeing? But then at the end you see him sort of fiddling around like he's sort of digitally done that image, like he's really just playing a sort of an arcade game or something. Yeah, that was just really weird. But I don't know. I think that...
He's trying to watch a boxing match or something.
Weird. I think at this time I was wanting to be watching a boxing match. But and that's the thing, like we spoke about Steve Martin's scene and then Alice Cooper. I think this film probably could have worked a lot better if each song was very much, I don't know, a guest artist doing a cover rather than try to make this plot thing happen. But unfortunately, that when you're making a motion picture, you can't really just sling a whole heap of promo videos together, which essentially is what this is.
Yeah, to an extent, but again, once it gets truly bizarre or truly low, it again came back, I think, with the next bit when they, even though they don't know where the final instrument is, they decide they need to go back and save Heartland by putting on a big show, and they come marching into town, being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, which is another song that I absolutely love. And just really doing so much of what is described in that song literally, which meant that there were two people in a horse costume
dancing the waltz,
roller skating as a waltz, and I'm thinking that is impressive. I really think that would take a lot of skill to get to just roller skate. as part of a pantomime horse, let alone actually do any sort of thing which resembles a waltz. I'm thinking, that's damn impressive. That's like a... How are they doing that? And, of course, with the Across the Universe thoughts in my head as well, I was making random comments as per Eddie Izzard, who did the song in Across the Universe, doing 10 somersaults upon the ground, whatever they are, which I think added to my enjoyment of this scene.
Well, that's definitely something that I must admit, I did think of you when this song came out in the movie, because I know you're a big fan, but I must admit, Eddie Izzard did do it better, and the editing was so much better in Across the Universe, because whilst in the 78, whilst in the Sergeant Pepper's film, they are, as you said, doing everything that is described. I felt that the Across the Universe definitely captured that psychedelic acid sort of feel of the period as well. So yeah, it did try well, definitely for 1978 standards to bring that song to life. And it was funny because earlier I remember seeing that Barry Gibb and or their characters were referred to as such and such Henderson, and I'm like, oh, that's right, the Hendersons are there, we'll all be there, blah blah blah. Yep. So a lot of things were starting to make a bit more sense. So and I did like, and even I think even George Burns got to do a bit of a verse, even though I wasn't quite a fan of last time he sang. But, yeah, anyway, they tied it in well with Mr. Kite and them coming back to town. And I did like the disco variation on the Sergeant Pepper's costume that they wore, like the traditional sort of sergeant's look with the white pants with, like, the little platforms or whatever. That was quite cool, very disco.
Like I said, this was one of the times, I think, where, it was a passable cover, I suppose you could say, but, given when you compare it to other parts of the movie, it stood out as, it definitely stood out as a highlight, as a bit more fun, because it was done, I think, with a bit more of the fun aspect in mind, which would have been nice if it had been through more of this movie.
Yeah, it was.
But I know you were mentioning before about songs that were hits. I think not long after this, as they had their tribute concert start, I think the biggest hit from this movie happened when Earth, Wind and Fire took the stage.
Oh, yes, I forgot about Got to Get You Into My Life, which another, I mentioned mm-hmm. Steve Martin earlier, but in a lot of, you know, recent research, the Earth, Wind, Fire scene comes up a lot as probably being the highlight of the film. And yeah, talk about disco movie. Like, it was actually really refreshing to see a scene where they didn't try to add any plot or have something happening in the background or edit it so heavily. It literally was like you're at a 70s concert watching this band live, and I thought it was actually pretty cool and groovy.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big hit for Earth, Wind and Fire. I mean, I think that they managed to separate that from the soundtrack in general, and they just ran with it as their own version of it. And yeah, that was great.
Yeah, and I wish, you know, I loved those that concert feel, as I said, when they did those concert songs and things like that. I know it wasn't Earth, Wind, Fire earlier, but when the Bee Gees were even doing it too, I don't know, it just gave it that sort of live freshness about it. But yeah, that scene definitely stood out, and I felt like I was waiting for it the entire movie, having heard about it, thinking, when's it going to come? Because we were sort of in the last 20 minutes by now.
Yeah, because things do happen quite rapidly and rapid fire. Like during that song, you've got Lucy and whatever the name of Peter Frampton's greedy brother was essentially established early on.
I think it was Dougie something. Dougie Shears, I think. Dougie Shears. I had to look it up. Yeah.
Yes, it's Dougie.
I don't know what that reference is.
But for some reason, yeah, they're together and they decide they're going to steal the money from the back room. But while they're doing that, Mustard comes along and kidnaps Strawberry. Mustard, that's not a sentence I thought I'd be saying ever. and then everyone, the Bee Gees take, even though it's nighttime when this all happens, suddenly it's daytime with the Bee Gees in hot pursuit in a pedal-powered hot air balloon.
Yeah, that's...
and suddenly they're there and they get to confront FVB, or Future Villain Band, played yes. by Aerosmith.
And as we mentioned
what
earlier...
What is going on?
But as we mentioned earlier, they didn't want to die the... What was it? So they didn't want to be killed. It had to be an accident, because I think they get electrocuted at the end, don't they?
Yeah, so they do, again, quite a decent version of Come Together, because they want to try to destroy the magic in the Sgt. Pepper Band's instruments, because suddenly everyone remembered that apparently these instruments are magical and help world peace or something.
Oh, we'd forgotten. Whoops.
it kind of comes up at the start and then is forgotten for quite some time. And then you're in the big battle. Aerosmith gets electrocuted and Strawberry, who's tied up, gets knocked off the stage. And then it gets very dark because they have full-on... She dies and they have like a glass casket funeral and Peter Frampton's there being super-duper sad. And walks off. I love the fact that when he walks off, he has... I'm not sure if it was meant to be a flashback to scenes that weren't in the movie. Because he's having memories of hanging with Strawberry by a river, and there's a dog running around them. You know, that typical super romantic PG type stuff. So I don't know if that was meant to be a flashback or of him envisioning what he wanted from the future with her. So it's just, again, it's just so out of place with the whole everything else in this movie. So yeah, so, I mean, yeah, the whole funeral thing, and then I think we already talked about a day in the life that happened after that, with just the strange flashbacks in there as well. And the great thing of Peter Frampton then attempting suicide by jumping off Strawberry Fields' roof. That was a nice touch.
Nice touch, but of course, whenever Peter Frampton's about to jump off a building, of course you have to. Who comes to the rescue? But I've got his name here. What is it? Billy Preston, who I believe in my research actually recorded "Get Back" with the Beatles originally when it first came out. So I assume I don't know much about him, but I know he did have a bit of a career with some other songs and stuff. So it was probably a nice touch, but wasn't expecting him to magically save him from suicide and essentially reverse everything that's just happened. That's kind of the vibe I was getting from what they meant. They were reversing as if all this bad stuff hadn't happened and we were back to the opening scene again. That's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well, considering he was the magic weather vane dude, you would have thought it would have been Sergeant Pepper, since it was Sergeant Pepper's weather vane, but no, it turns into Billy Preston, and he comes down and sings "Get Back" and refers to all the characters, but by the names in the song "Get Back," so it doesn't call anyone by the right name, turns Mr. Mustard and all the bad guys into, well, Mr. Mustard gets turned into the Pope, and the other bad guys get turned into clergy for some strange reason, and he brings Strawberry back from the dead. It's a very high energy song. I mean, it is actually probably one of the better cover versions in the entire movie, but, the goings on during it are just like, what did you do now? Why is he the Pope? And Strawberry is just there? Okay, fine. And you're calling her Loretta. That might be confusing for her.
Yeah, well, that's it's almost like I think they got to this stage and went, oh, we better sum this movie up. We've still got a couple more songs. We've still got Get Back in our contract. We better do that. But, as you said, after coming out of that sort of funeral thing with Day in the Life, it's like they kind of kept wanting to have that sort of death sort of negativity going. And literally, I thought them reversing literally was almost like reversing our brains and kind of wishing we'd never seen half the things that we'd seen before. Actually, that's another thing I noticed. Actually, is A Day in the Life is when Barry Gibb actually sits down and just sits facing his brothers and just sings the line, "I'd love to turn you on." And I was just like, as we said, a time when the lyrics probably don't really suit necessarily what's happening. But yeah, that the Billy Preston scene definitely sort of saved the ending of it, even if it did have all those dodgy, very 1978 Doctor Strange special effects, let's just say. the flashing of light. Oh gosh, that could be a double feature. Anyway, maybe not.
That would mean watching that Doctor Strange movie again. I'm in no hurry to do that.
Would you not speak of that again?
But I could have put this at the trigger at the start, and I know you were sort of like, you know, you have questioned a few times where that $18 million budget went. But yeah, very quickly they go from everyone being happy at the end to the reprise of Sergeant Pepper's in a massive group sing-along full of a lot of people in there, like I believe Tina Turner's in there, Dame Edna is in the middle of this group for some reason. You got Bobby Womack. You've just got a lot of very familiar faces. A number of familiar faces, a lot of vaguely recognizable faces, and a bunch of who are they again? But apparently the producers actually sent out an open invitation to the entertainment world to come in and just perform in this one song, and everyone who turned up got flown in. They all got treated to a lavish dinner, and they all had deluxe camping accommodation just to be in this final big sing-along of Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So I'm thinking lot of the budget went to that.
Well, and that's the thing, like I'd mentioned earlier, you know, a few of the songs from this, you know, a few scenes, you know, would be sort of become infamous. But yeah, this was another one I heard a lot of reference to, you know, and I think, as you said, most of the budget probably went to that. And I think a lot of those actors, too, would have been quite desperate for some kind of appearance in a movie. It was very much a who's who of 70s pop culture. I had to laugh. Carol Channing was even in there. But she looked like she was off with the fairies. She was still singing. She was still singing the Skidoo theme song. Not realizing.
No. Don't talk about that movie! No!
But I must admit, it was pretty funny looking at all the individual performers and a lot of them that either really knew it, was putting a lot of effort in, or people that were just happy for the the glamping that they were provided with.
Yeah. Well, there was some very bad lip syncing in amongst that crowd that I noticed. But yeah, I mean, that led into the closing credits, and when it actually got to the credits for that final song, I mean, I was watching that crawl with so many names, just eagle eyed, just going, I know them, I know them, I know them. It kind of like got me excited again. It's like, just as this little bit at the end, which is just, I think sort of like showed what the movie could have been if they had just tried to make it a straight out musical rather than turning it into some sort of shoehorned in force story, making them use the song as the actual scenes, rather it could just been a setup for a song. You know, that I think that probably would have served them better in the long run.
Oh, like sort of like an ensemble film where, hey, they only need to film a scene here and there, but have Carol Channing come in one spot, or have Tina Turner make an appearance in one song. But yeah, as you said, it was like a bit of an afterthought, and you do wonder if it was like a last minute thing. One of those things they thought would redeem the movie, possibly, or when they thought it was going to go bad. But I did think it was kind of cool at the end, where that it was kind of almost like they were posing like the Sgt. Pepper's album cover, even though it's a very weird version of the album cover, but let's just say that was kind of cool, that kind of reference there, and then how that then stayed as the pose while the credits went over. I thought that was pretty cool, but yeah, and then I was thinking to myself, oh, they probably should have had some cameos by the Beatles at the end. I'm like, nah, they were probably wise distancing themselves from this as much as possible.
Yeah. I think, as mentioned earlier, the Beatles, I think, had nothing to do with this this interpretation of their music. Let's just put it that way. Now, hopefully people listening aren't going to pick up the fact that we've had a lot of technical issues recording this tonight. So I think it's probably best that we do move on nice and fast. So was there any last bits and pieces or anything particularly bizarre or weird or incredible that you wanted to mention from the movie itself?
Oh, well, I actually think, well, there's lots of bizarre things. But yeah, I think we've covered most of it. I'm happy Fair to enough. Tackle the dubious or the questionable, you know, is it redeemable? So unless you have any more to state, I'm happy to move on.
Fair enough. Well, you did suggest this one, Christian. So as per our tradition, I shall go first with my thoughts as to any redeemability within this movie. And look, I've got to say straight up, I've got very, very mixed feelings about this movie. There were scenes where it almost tried to be a bit more serious and they just completely fell apart. But then you had the bigger numbers where they had a bit more fun. And I think that those are what carried the movie and it certainly helped me get through. Again, like when it starts, though, it's so fast paced, and the opening songs come so thick and fast. It's hard to wonder how they'd make it last a movie. Hey, keep that pace going, and of course that pace does actually drop off. I did enjoy playing Spot the Face in that finale, even though Dame Edna showing up was just like, what the hell? But look, in the end, I mean, if some of the music and some of the more high-energy set pieces could have basically made this a Sgt. Pepper's cover album music video. And at the end of the day, it was those better scenes which I think made it enjoyable enough for me. It's certainly not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination, but I think in the end, it's fun enough to watch. So therefore, I'm edging, it's close to the borderline, but I had enough of a good time to say that I did find it redeemable.
Wow. Oh, fantastic, Trevor. Wow. No pressure for me or anything.
No, not at all.
Like with a lot of our reviews that we hear from other, the Amazon reviews or the IMDb reviews, I found myself actually nodding to a lot of the things you were just saying, Trevor. I think possibly, you know, it was so hard not to think about Across the Universe, you know, another version of, you know, using the Beatles back catalogue to pretty much put a musical or, you know, a movie together. But I mentioned musical, and I think It actually, you know, I said it was based on a stage show. I actually think it would have worked better as a stage show, I think, using, you know, using each song as, I suppose, like you said, individual promo videos. But unfortunately, they're not edited fast enough or edited in such an innovative sort of MTV style that you can really call them promo videos. But there's, a, you know, there's a lot of, you know, as I said, a lot of covers on there that are passable, a lot of covers that are better than passable, and there's probably a few songs, you know, especially those involving the robots, which should have been cut out. And I think looking at it in that respect, like you said, it could have been a Sgt. Pepper's cover album. I know the album itself runs for about 39 minutes. And I think, hey, 39 minutes of what we saw would have been a lot more sort of, I suppose, palatable, and especially for mainstream audiences too. So, you know, that could have been another thing. I felt, I love all the Beatles music, but I think as soon as it strayed from the Sgt. Pepper stuff about 20 minutes into it, I kind of, it lost me a little bit in that respect. It lost its concept, I suppose. So, it didn't drag, of course, to segue on from Dame Nedna, it didn't drag as a movie, and yeah, I definitely, I think that once, you know, I remember seeing when it was an hour 50 going, oh, Trevor's going to kill me. I must admit, about 40 minutes into it, that was the first time I looked at my watch, and I'm like, oh, God, that went really fast. So, Trevor, I'm very much in support of you. I think it's not so bad, it's good, but it's definitely not unwatchable. I could easily put that on in the background, even as a Beatles album to be listening to. I don't see why it's the worst soundtrack of all time, maybe taken out of context of the movie. But yeah, it's a fun romp and a good way. Hey, I like any way that the Beatles music is presented and being able to see it in a different way. And yeah, I do think this is definitely, even if it is on the cusp, I think this is definitely a redeemable movie.
Woo-hoo! That's, we did that's it. Two in a row, I believe, Christian. That's pretty amazing.
I must admit, when I suggested this film, I did not see that coming at all. I thought it would be a unanimous no. So I'm glad to prove myself wrong.
It's always good. I mean, I think this counts as a nice surprise. I mean, definitely. While I won't be rushing back to it, yeah, it was enjoyable enough. So, yep, we have got another redeemable. And we may have only just redeemed it, but this is a movie that does have its fans, and I do have another review lined up to, I suppose, see us out and finish on that very positive note that we do try to finish on as much as we can. So the title of this review is A Little Campy But Non-Stop Beatles Music. There are no spoken words in this except for George Burns narrating, so you never need concern yourself as to the acting ability of so many famous musicians. It's just one song after another, and the interpretations of the songs are so cleverly twisted to fit the plot of the movie. For example, Strawberry Fields, the song is sung by a character named Strawberry Fields to help illustrate her part in the movie, and Steve Martin's performance of Maxwell Silver Hammer as Dr. Maxwell is quite memorable because he put so much of himself into it. It was as though the Beatles had him in mind when they wrote the song. Sure, sometimes a song's connection to the plot can be a bit stretched or convoluted, but you don't care because it's Beatles music. Remember to watch it until the very end so you can see a chorus of innumerable celebrities singing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I'd say that it's reminiscent of Xanadu, just without the hackneyed acting. 5 stars.
Good review. They probably shouldn't have brought the Xanadu bit at the end, but yeah, I can see the connection. So yeah, I can see, yeah, I definitely think if you sort of let its campness and just, as you, I think the opening line, I think, camp, but a chance to hear a whole heap of Beatles songs, I think that summed it up in a nutshell.
There we go. Yeah, a time when camp does actually help save a movie. Cause...
Yeah, definitely.
Campy,
no,
just
no pressure.
No pressure on me. No.
Yeah, I was going to say, no God. Pressure now. I don't know if you're going to give us campy musical. I don't know how you can segue from this.
I think it's safe to say that the movie I've got in mind is far, far, far removed from both campy and musical. Can't make them into it, but I guess we'll have to find out. That's a perfect segue, so I shall move on to see what our next challenge will be. What I've chosen is a movie that attempts to make something new from something that was previously established, and this particular movie had so much fanfare in the lead up and was so much hope out there and being expressed by fans of the characters, because it was also meant to be the building base of a whole new franchise. But it ended up dividing fans and critics alike. Now, movies have continued, and the latest movie in the franchise is actually hitting theatres around about now, around the place. So I think it makes it timely to check out the movie that introduced the new Wonder Woman character to the cinema audiences. So we are going and having a look at the DC Comics 2016 attempt to play catch-up with the Marvel movies by their blockbuster crossover attempt at epic Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice.
Oh my god. And Trevor, this has, from someone who's not into these movies whatsoever, I have heard the infamy surrounding this movie, and quite a lot of people that despised it, so I'm interested. I'm up for the challenge, I think. And I don't think I'd ever normally watch this kind of movie, so... Wow, a nice movie. It was me thinking... When you said 2016, I think it's like 2016 Wonder Woman. I'm like, what? There was a Wonder Woman movie last year? But yeah, I suppose there essentially was. So.
Yeah. Wonder Woman is about to hit, so... And now everyone's pinning their hope on Wonder Woman for the DC movies.
Wow, this definitely is a good time. So from Beatles to Batman, I think we're up for the challenge for sure.
Absolutely. Now, if you do want to check this out, it is available to stream on both Netflix and Foxtel Play, or it's pretty much rentable on everything, Dendy Direct, Google Play, iTunes, and the PlayStation and Microsoft stores. So this is actually a nice, easy one to watch, because I actually think some of our previous ones we've had recently... a bit hard to find, let's put it that way, in the general digital distribution that we have in more recent times. So, yeah, this is an easy one for you to check out before the next podcast. Oh, boy.
So we have no excuse. So no excuse not to watch this. But yeah, definitely.
We have to watch it. You have to watch it.
I definitely think we're due for a superhero movie. It does feel like a while.
Yeah. I think we started with Fantastic Four this year, but...
I don't know. They all blend into one another.
Yeah. And of course, we would love to hear from anyone out there. Do you think we've been a bit too harsh on Sergeant Peppers? Do you think we've been a bit too generous? Do you have any comments, redeeming or otherwise, that you would like to let us know about Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice? Definitely let us know. We're very easy to get in touch with. You can head to our homepage, RufusProject.com, and leave a comment below this very episode. You can find the Rufus Project on Twitter and Facebook, or you can send us an email to podcast@RufusProject.com. We would love to hear your thoughts, and we'd also love to hear it if you have any suggestions for movies that you think could be a challenge for us to try to redeem in the future.
Oh, and there's plenty out there, I'm sure. And even though we're thinking we're getting through the list, there's still heaps more that we hear about. So, yeah, always come forward with those. Because some of our choices can be a bit weird and wonderful, so we like hearing from some other people as well.
Absolutely. So, I'm sure as some of you out there know, Christian Fletcher, his events are quite famous, or in some cases infamous, around Brisbane. So, Christian, is there anything in particular that you've got coming up that you'd like to plug?
Oh, well, I don't know if this will get in time, but we've got the Beatles' Sergeant Pepper's anniversary, not the screening of the movie, but on Sunday the 4th of June at New Globe Theatre. We've got the continuation of our Roaring Twenties classic cinema on the 9th of June. I'm returning to my retro dance parties to New Farm Bowls Club, which is a 50s and 60s party on the 10th, and some other ones with 60s, 70s and 80s music. Rocky Horror's coming up on the 16th of June, has already sold out. It's been so popular, so make sure you get in now for the 22nd of September. I never thought I'd be promoting a screening that far in advance, and definitely look at christianfletcher.com for upcoming events.
Absolutely. Now, if you haven't had enough of my voice yet, I do have another podcast that I do with my wife Susie in a very, very different vein. Instead of a long rambling conversation about bad movies, Susie and I have short little bits of bizarre history that you can listen to quite easily and quickly on a commute, during a coffee break, whenever. I don't think we've had an episode more than 20 minutes. And that is What the History, available at wthpod.rufusproject.com. Or if you can have, of course, search for the What the History podcast on your favorite podcast app. That's certainly a fun little podcast to listen to. And it's educational, too. Ooh.
That's always good, as opposed to bad movies.
Well, they're kind of educational. You learn what to avoid.
Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, what not to never talk about again. Or if the things that you want to avoid, we'll make sure we bring them up again.
Excellent. And on that note, I think, again, it's been rather an interesting recording experience. I'm hoping that we can edit it up nicely so you guys won't feel the pain that Christian and I have gone through in putting this podcast together tonight. So thank you, Christian, for your patience. I'm pretty sure most of the technical issues were at my end this time. Hopefully everything will go a lot smoother in a couple of weeks when we come back to talk Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice.
I'm looking forward to it. Oh, you've got to always remember that extra line.
Absolutely.
Looking forward to it, Trevor. Thank you.
Awesome. I'll chat to you then.
Master Wayne. Thermal imaging is showing me 24 hostiles on the third floor. Why don't I drop you off on the second?
Even you got too old to die young. Not for lack of trying.
He has the power to wipe out the entire human race. If we believe there's even a 1% chance that he is our enemy, we have to take it as an absolute certainty.
The greatest gladiator match in the history of the world. God versus man. Day versus night.
You're psychotic.
That is a three-syllable word for any thought too big for little minds.
I know a few women like you.
Oh, I don't think you've ever known a woman like me.
That power can be innocent.
Creatures, but we want to know what a redeeming feature.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm the bee, says it's bad, but we want to know is it fun to be had.
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
Maxwell Edison, Major.
call her on the phone.